Hello everybody, my name is Guy Foster and in a moment you are about to hear another Brewin podcast, and in this edition we're going to be kind of zooming out away from the micro issues confronting companies, markets, maybe even economies for the foreseeable future, but really looking at the issues facing society as a whole, as seen by our guest this week, who is none other than Jamie Bartlett, an expert on cybercrime, the darknet, and the way that the internet and technology is changing the future of our society. So I really hope you're going to enjoy this podcast, which will come up after the following messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Okay, so hello everybody, welcome to another Brewin podcast with me, Guy Foster, the head of research at Brewin Dolphin. Now today, slightly unusual guest compared to the usual very finance-related individuals we tend to talk to. We are talking to Jamie Bartlett. He is the director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos. That's probably not someone who you woke up this morning thinking, I must hear from this individual. But I am confident that when you listen to what he has to say, you're going to find it very enlightening. You may also know he writes for The Spectator, The Telegraph. He did a series on BBC Two, and he's written three books. One about the darknet, one called Radicals Chasing Utopia, one about the people versus technology. And I guess they sort of start as a sort of everything you need to know about the darknet, and then become increasingly prophetic, I guess, as they go on. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I guess I started off writing the darknet with a very simple idea in mind, which was there's lots of very interesting uses of technology in the hidden underbelly of the net.
Yeah.
And most people ignore it and say, oh, it's criminal, it's disgraceful, it's terrible what people are doing down here. And I actually found that a lot of people that were talking about the terrible things happening on the internet hadn't gone to find it for themselves.
Yeah.
So I just basically immersed myself for a year in weird internet subcultures, the sort of darkest ones you could find. And of course, this was back in 2014, and these guys are all talking about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and encryption and things actually that most of us weren't thinking that much about, but that have since come to be very important, including for your industry, I guess.
Yes, and of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same with the internet. I spent a huge amount of time with internet trolls, with various forms of hackers, neo-Nazis using the internet smartly, all things that actually over the last 5 years since that book came out seem to have got more and more popular.
That's really interesting. So do you think, is the darknet going to be like a place, should we all be checking there to find out what's going to be next year's weird trend or development or something like that?
Well, yeah. Honestly, I think so. Places that you'll find more interesting things about new applications of technology in Reddit, subreddits, and threads on weird forums and hacker forums on the darknet than you probably will at a TED talk.
Right.
If you can be bothered to go in there and take a look. And I guess it's based on the argument that outsiders in society tend to be quite early adopters of new technology, whether it's because they're a criminal mindset and they're looking for ways of evading the police, or whether it's just because they think that the mainstream ignores them, so they disappear off into a subculture somewhere. And that's the same with my second book about radical political movements. I looked at all these fringe groups and thought the future of politics is going to be very different. And so, for example, I predicted, given this week, that the next big movement would be radical environmentalism, direct action environmentalism, and they would start shutting streets down. And, you know, I wrote this 2.5 years ago, and look what happened last week with these Extinction Rebellion people in London shutting down the city for 2 weeks.
So what drove that prediction then? Was it that you bumped into someone on the darknet, that there was a pattern forming?
It's the same philosophy, really. I'm always looking for these little fringe ideas from fringe movements that look to me like they're about to enjoy a sudden spurt of growth if certain conditions are present. And with the radical environmentalists, these weren't on the darknet. These were when I was doing my second book and just spending time on the fringes of politics rather than on the fringes of the internet.
Yeah.
And I could see that they were hugely motivated. They were growing very quickly. You know when you see the sort of beginning of something going viral where you spot a sudden, but I think Google called it burstiness, a sudden surge of activity before anyone else spots it. That was what was happening with the environmentalists. And I could see that their philosophy was things are getting worse. We have science on our side. Politics can't fix this. The only solution is going to be direct action, chaining ourselves to things and shutting things down because that's the only thing that's left to us. And the logic just seemed to add up.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty obvious to me that this was going to happen.
Yeah, and I guess that... So I'm going to sort of try and provoke you here then. So that sounds like a response to a failure of a conventional political system.
Yes.
Then, and your third book is sort of lamenting what might happen to the conventional political system. But as a starter for that, isn't it good that there would be some disruption to this political system, given that it does seem to, you know, miss some fairly glaring issues that need addressing?
Yes, I think that's true. That's true. But the problem is if you have too much disruption, then the whole thing collapses. I mean, my sort of thinking on this is what's very healthy is a constant level of radicalism, of disagreement, of activism that keeps the system healthy. You know, the direct action of environmentalists, if they're able, if everything they hope for came true, that would be a pretty disastrous outcome for lots of people, actually. But if they were able to just shake the system up a little bit and put some of their ideas on the agenda, that's the kind of thing that keeps society ticking over. So you do need a certain level of disruption. I guess my worry in my third book about the arrival of powerful artificial intelligence and smart machines and decentralized systems, ubiquitous encryption, ubiquitous sensors, is that the level of disruption, potentially anyway, is so great, so significant, that our model of democracy that we have now just can't really withstand it.
Okay, and so is that not then... I mean, I think one of the success stories that a lot of people would point to is that we've seen non-democratic systems which probably wouldn't have been toppled had it not been for the liberating force of technology.
Yes, but the world has become less democratic in the last 10 years. I mean, I don't mean this just anecdotally. I mean, if you look at the Economist's Index of Democracy and the Index on Censorship, level of freedom around the world has become less democratic and less free in the last 10 years, after quite some years of it getting better. And I don't think that's a coincidence that that's happened around the same time as the use of digital technologies has increased. I felt like maybe we were slightly naive about there was inevitably going to be a democratizing effect once these technologies... I mean, I was one of those people. I was very naive about it because I thought, oh, the Arab Spring, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you can't control technology.
Yeah.
Freedom, free press, free expression. And of course, what we learn is no, there's always a centralizing force as well. And often central governments will come down slowly but very powerfully on this technology. And if you speak to someone in China and say, well, do you think the internet has helped you as a freedom fighter? I mean, you know what the answer's going to be, don't you?
Yeah.
So it's not that the potential isn't there, of course. I mean, I think there's a lot of countries where it has made society more free, and it's made us more free in lots of ways individually as well. I mean, like the things we can access and the things we can say. But on aggregate, I'm not sure whether that's true.
And so, I mean, I'm trying to think. Like, I do recall seeing that issue of the Economist Democracy Index. Isn't it very heavily skewed by what what goes on in the US and China? Isn't that what the factor that...
No, I don't think... I mean, I think that's true as well, because I think both of those countries may have become less democratic.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at the number of countries that whose democratic index has gone down, I think more than half of them have either remained steady or declined, and fewer than half of them have increased. So I even though those two are the sort of big obvious cases, and I think maybe, especially in terms of freedom of the press, I think those two have really done particularly badly. I think it's a bit of a bigger thing, because that index looks like 30 or maybe 50 indicators. So it's quite a broad look at countries. But remember, I mean, what I was trying to do with this book actually is more to say, in 20 years, what will it look like?
I
think it's still an open question, but I was sort of, I suppose, in my dystopian mood at the time, I was thinking, well, let's project these trends that we're seeing at the moment forward 20 years, then we might have some big trouble.
Okay, so what are the choices then that are going to determine those outcomes?
I don't tend to blame technology. I actually increasingly look at both our choices as individuals and government's ability to feel itself confident enough to regulate where it needs to regulate. And one obvious example is on election rules.
Yeah.
Everyone talking about Cambridge Analytica and did they cheat the election and did Trump cheat and Brexit was that... I think they're missing the point. I think the point is there's new methods and techniques now used routinely in elections around the world, and no country has yet really put in any measures that would allow a democratically elected government to make sure everyone agrees that people are playing fairly by the rules. And what that allows everyone to do is accuse everybody else of cheating all the time. So what would happen, had Clinton won the election in 2016, the Trump side would have said, but you're using data analytics to micro-target people and it's not fair and it's ruining our democracy. And they would have had a point. It's not just about one party or another. But if governments haven't been able to update election law yet, because it's still in a model that's really about television, radio and posters, then it's their fault partly. So
yeah.
I think there's some easy things that governments can do.
You know, it's really fascinating. A year ago in this very room... we on this podcast, we interviewed Sir Christopher Mayer, the former head of the Press Complaints Commission, and he talked about the unregulated part of the media that really was just emerging during his tenure. I mean, there doesn't seem a way in which you can't consider that to be a liberalising force, but your point is that it may be very liberal, but it's in a sort of... anarchic sense of liberal rather than a liberating sense of liberal.
Yeah, because liberal changes do also are always rules based, aren't they? I mean, the idea is you've got a set of rules.
Yeah.
They're sort of democratically created and they're transparent, and the people that are subject to them have the opportunity to determine how they're constructed and monitored. That to me is what a liberal sort of rule of law is. And I think that's... Yes, we have something that's completely unregulated. People either cheat or accuse other people of cheating, and then nobody trusts the results. And I mean, I certainly can't remember in my lifetime elections that were so contested as the last two big ones that we've had. And I'm certain that the European elections, if they go ahead, will be full of claims and counterclaims of other people cheating and Russian interference and bots being used to manipulate public opinion. Whether or not it works, or it's another question, but people will say that it's unregulated. And I'm really talking about what simple things can governments actually do to show that there is a set of rules that people have to follow in important things like elections.
Yeah.
And if they can't even do that, I don't think there's much point in pointing the finger at the big tech companies and saying, well, a lot of them are asking for some rules to help, so they know what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But I also blame us slightly as well. I mean, we are building the systems that people complain about, and there's definitely an anti-technology feel in society at the moment, is a product of all of us loving these technologies and preferring to share all our information rather than worrying about privacy or data integrity or whatever. So each of us is in some ways culpable. And in that book, I say we're building the world we want. So if we want a different world, and we don't like mega monopolies or whatever, then we should change our behaviour.
Which is a sort of interesting parallel to that comment that people often make about politics, that you get the people get the politicians that they deserve.
Yeah, and I think that's true, and I think we're getting the technology companies we deserve as well. It's exactly the same.
And so what, like, is there a, do you think people should just generally be a bit more coy with their data?
I really do, because I'm thinking about, well, in 20 years time, if Moore's law continues, this is, I'm always 20 years time frame, Moore's law, which, you know, the power, the computing speed roughly doubles every 18 months, if that carries on, we don't really know. But that would mean that in 20 years' time, your phone will be 32,000 times more powerful than it is today. And so you can think about how powerful supercomputers will be, the quality of the nudging algorithms that will be able to be created, the predictive technologies that will work out your foot, you know, your likely trajectory throughout the day and nudge you at various places, and how that could be misused. The fuel of all of it is the data that we are sharing. I mean, that's what's driving these tremendous advances with amazing benefits to all of us. But if we're not, if we don't care at all about what we're sharing and how and when and play, and, you know, just completely disinterested in what happens to that data, then we shouldn't really complain in 20 years' time if we've built some terrible dystopia because it's our fault.
Yeah.
So I would like to see people doing some pretty simple things, and it's not that hard. I mean, you can. There are search, the classic example, I suppose, is search engines. I mean, everyone complains about Google being a mega monopoly, but nobody stops using Google.
No.
Because it's so good. Well, if you want a more healthy, competitive search engine system, then start using some of Google's competitors. But that means your search results will not be as good.
But you could use it not signed in, can't you? Yes, you can.
And you can also, you could use a Tor browser, which I'll talk about, the thing on the darknet for, and use that on Google.
People wonder, why are you using that, eh?
Well, no, people will.
Mum wants to know why you're using the Tor browser that is associated with the darknet, where you get bad things.
That's
in
right.
In addition to other stuff.
That's right. I mean, but a 16-year-old already knows how to hide it from his mother usually already, so it's not really a problem. Little things like that, would it be each of us doing our job in some ways to make sure that we're not building, that we aren't creating a mega information monopoly that we're worried about. Maybe you don't mind about that, so then that's fine. But if you do, there are things you can do to change it.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, and this isn't really a podcast about me, but I mean, I must be someone you frown upon, because I don't really take that. I'm not very coy with my data. I kind of hope that I get a better shopping experience at some stage by being very generous with my data. And at the moment, I'm always kind of underwhelmed with the fact that all it seems to mean is that I look at a T-shirt one day and then it seems to be following me around the internet for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
I mean, is there something more sinister going on behind this facade of very crude cookie usage or something?
Yeah. It's a good question, and I've been saying to people that if you want to brighten up your internet experience, just go and look at your favourite piece of art online, and then it will follow you around for the rest of the week, and your sidebar will always be full of joy.
Yeah.
I'm thinking 20 years down the line. I agree with you. You buy a wallet, and the next day you keep getting adverts for wallets. It's not particularly sophisticated, but I think we're beginning to see pretty impressive improvements in how good that actually is. I mean, if you look at what Cambridge Analytica did in the election, 5,000 data points on 250 million Americans, and we're combining all sorts of different data sets here, not just web browsing, but remember, the web browsing bit is one bit of it. This is being combined with your offline data about which magazines you've been buying in the shops, what your mortgage rate is, what car you own, and all of this stuff as well. So there's huge amounts of pretty large data brokerage companies that have been combining data sets to build up quite impressively detailed profiles on people. And I guess I just worry about the misuses of that 10 or 15 or 20 years down the line, given we're going to create more and more and more and more data and we'll know less and less and less about it and who has it. And you can imagine that, I mean, what happens if a government that doesn't really respect individual rights or liberties is elected in 20 years' time and suddenly realises that there's all these data sets on all these people that could be used. That's what worries me. And we've seen that before with IBM in the Netherlands in the 1930s, using its punch card technology to register Jewish people, which was then taken over by the Nazis when they came in. And I know this just sounds like I'm, you know, fear-mongering here, but I think it makes sense to just be cautious about that, because you've seen over the last 10 years how much politics has changed, and you can imagine it changing some more. And so I guess I worry about what we're building and who might use it in future.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're kind of running out of time. So as a way of concluding, do you have like a sort of checklist of things that you should do? Delete your cookies, change your password, only use Tor or something like that? Is there a guide to not being part of the problem?
I don't want to, but I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone, you know. I mean, I'm part, okay, so one thing that I've realised is that attention, a personal attention, the ability to focus on things and work out what matters to you, and to consume in a meaningful way complex ideas and information, is such an important baseline skill for a citizen to have. I'd say it's more important than voting. And I'm sure most of your listeners will say, of course I vote. Even if it doesn't matter, it's a duty as a citizen.
Yeah.
We are losing that ability to think critically about things and engage with information, because so many of us find ourselves distracted constantly by the pull of a machine, whether it's your phone or your desktop, and soon it will be all sorts of other technologies too that understand you better and better every year. And maintaining your ability to focus and concentrate and having switch off times and not checking phones for 2 hours and not checking them first thing in the morning is actually, I think, a duty as a citizen, because otherwise you will not be able to sit down and read the Brexit white paper, because you won't be able to concentrate on it properly.
No.
Because you'll be thinking too much, oh, I should tweet about this, or I should, yes. What's everyone else saying? And you can't form an idea. And at an individual level, maybe that doesn't matter, but if you spread that across 70 million people, what you find is everyone's quality of debate and discussion is declining gradually, and we almost can't see it happening. So in addition to all the things about, well, maybe use Tor, and maybe use a different search engine sometimes, and maybe don't always use the same app, taxi service, whatever it is, I think there's a bigger thing about each of us taking our duty as a citizen who needs to concentrate and think seriously, and that requires actually a bit like fitness or diet. It's something you have to work on.
Yeah, so I mean, that's more of a sort of personal life coaching thing, then, isn't it? And there's all sorts of, you're more productive if your phone isn't in your pocket.
Do you stuff like this?
I mean, yeah, we do, absolutely. Yeah. Like turn off the little thing that says you've just got an email.
Yeah, oh God, yeah.
You know, check your email twice a day. You know, all of that stuff. I mean, you've got to concentrate on
it. Yeah, you do it at work, don't you? I think your personal time is good as well.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is in danger of turning into a personal therapy session for me. And I'm not sure that's going to be the most enlightening thing for our listeners. So I think on that note, Jamie Bartlett, thank you very much for sharing those somewhat bleak visions of the future. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in for another Bruin podcast. We hope you've found getting this different angle on technology, which we've often talked about the investment merits of, which have clearly been fantastic. And we hope that you will join us again for another Bruin podcast very shortly.